Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Planning for Change at the System Level, Interoperable Open Architecture. I'm Kurt Schwader, Technical Editor at Open Systems Media, and today's moderator with speaker Edwin DeYoung from Real Time Innovations. Today's briefing is scheduled for about 50 minutes, leaving a 10-minute Q&A at the end. Before we begin, though, I'd like to run down some features of your audience console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button will allow you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box and Submit Question buttons allow you to participate in today's eCast. You simply type your question into the text box and submit it by clicking on the button. We encourage you to do so early and often while the question is still fresh in your mind, and we'll attempt to get to all of those at the end of the presentation. If you have a question or problem pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you can submit those too, and one of our technicians will get back with you immediately. Finally, this eCast will be posted online within the 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will also be made available. We'll talk a little bit more about this at the end of the presentation. Distributed Data Service, or DDS, is a standard that governs how information source objects interact with information sinks. DDS is a data-centric approach that greatly simplifies complex distributed systems development. In this eCast, Dr. DeYoung will look at open architecture as applied to defense applications and their new procurement initiatives. Dr. Edwin DeYoung is a Director of Product Management and Strategy, Core Products at Real Time Innovations. He has more than 15 years of experience in the architecture and design of large-scale distributed real-time systems. These systems encompass C4I, radar, track management, multi-sensor data fusion, threat evaluation, weapon and sensor assignment, and simulation and training. Edwin currently serves RTI as the Director of Product Management and Strategy. Edwin joined RTI in 2005 following RTI's acquisition of Fortech, a company he co-founded in 2002 and led as CEO. Fortech provided products and services for distributed real-time database management. Fortech's customers were major defense contracts, including Thales and Northrop Grumman. Dr. DeJean, the floor is yours.
Thank you for the introduction, Kurt, and hi, everyone. Welcome to our webinar today. Thank you for joining us. I'm Edwin DeYoung, and I'm responsible for product management and strategy at RTI. And I will give you a very quick overview of RTI, who we are in a minute, just in case you're not really familiar with us. But first, I'd like to introduce the topic of this this webinar today. So in the last couple of years, we've seen a change in the way government procurement is taking place. And this change is subtle, but very important. What we see is that the government is trying to reduce the through life cycle maintenance and modification costs of their systems, of course, I would say, and at the same time, they are trying to increase the flexibility in system deployment, and they are trying to decrease the response time to changes in conflict situations. And what we see as a result of that is that the government is now looking to specify architecture used across a multitude of systems. And what we want to do in this webinar is review this this trend and then also explain that by using an architecture that is based on open standards and data integration, we can cost-effectively achieve interoperability across a wide range of systems, subsystems, and systems of systems. Also, as part of the webinar, I'd like to discuss some large programs both here in the U.S. And in other NATO countries that are already adopting an interoperable open architecture. So this is what we'll cover during the webinar. I'd like to start out with a brief introduction to who we are, what is RTI, and just in brief, we're a technology and product provider. We are enabling open architecture. And in doing that, we have seen a commonality of approach by defense procurement agencies, motivated by continued pressure for faster, better, and cheaper systems. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. Let's go back to the overview first. So after the introduction, I'd like to outline the change in the defense market that we're seeing. What we see is there's a fundamental shift occurring in the way that defense procurement is happening in the future. And this shift will change the market organization in defense. It will radically improve innovation, competition, and interoperability, and it will also improve agility of deployed systems to respond to threats in the field. This change that we'll be talking about has already started, in fact, and it is evidenced by a multitude of programs. And particularly in this webinar, I want to discuss two examples of that. Those are the Generic Vehicle Architecture, or GVA, which is a program by the UK MOD. And the second example that I want to discuss is a big program here in the US, which is the UCS program, which stands for Unmanned Aircraft System Control Segment. So we'll discuss those in a little bit more detail later. And besides those two programs, we are aware of many other defense agencies following a very similar path, both in Europe and in the US. So in this presentation, we'll take you through the drivers of this change and explain what the change really is. But before we get there, first a quick overview of RTI. So we are an integration infrastructure provider for real-time applications. We are being used across industries, including defense, of course, but also, for example, financial services and industrial control. We are headquartered in Sunnyvale, California, and we have offices worldwide, including in Europe. So the integration infrastructure solution that we provide is built around a distributed data bus. This data bus provides interoperability between systems and subsystems, and it facilitates and accelerates integration of distributed systems and systems of systems. And from this background, RTI is involved in all kinds of interoperability standards. So, for example, together with other companies, we were the author of the OMG Data Distribution Service, or DDS, standard. And DDS has been adopted, or is even mandated, by many defense programs worldwide. Besides with other companies, including systems integrators, we are also working with defense agencies on standards and interoperability. The earliest example of that is probably Navy Open Architecture, Navy OA, back in 2004, 2005. And Navy OA was actually the first to mandate the DDS standard for real-time systems integration, for real-time publish subscribe. A more recent example that I mentioned earlier already is UCS. UCS is a program here in the U.S. defining a common architecture for ground control stations and UAVs, and we'll talk more about UCS later in this webinar. So our technology is being used in hundreds of applications worldwide, where open architecture and interoperability are important issues, and this slide shows just a couple of examples. Now, all these programs, they all care about interoperability in one form or another, and we've seen the successes of those programs and frankly, the failures as well. So our integration solution is successfully deployed in over 400 unique applications. And just to mention a few examples, we are being used in the Aegis weapon system, where our infrastructure is used to integrate radars, weapon systems, displays, and command and control systems. And in general, I can say we're being used pervasively by the U.S. Navy. Another example is Northrop Grumman's CLIP program. CLIP stands for Common Link Integration Processing. And you can think of it as a data bridge in the sky. Our integration solution in CLIP provides the net-centric interface that allows integration of new and legacy data links. We are also being used in unmanned systems and ground control stations. You can actually see a couple of examples on this this slide here. So we are used in the advanced ground control station for Predator, for example. That one is depicted in the right bottom section of this slide. We're also being used in RoboScout, which is an unmanned ground vehicle. You can see RoboScout here in the top right right corner. And RoboScout is designed to be configurable for multiple future payload requirements. So it has a very configurable architecture. And talking about configurability, and with this, I want to now move to the main topic of this this webinar. So speaking about configurability, everyone idealizes the App Store model today as the model for all communities that that develop software applications. And I think we all have to admit that never has it been easier to get new applications and utilities on your phone and also nowadays on your computer. So that now suppose that you need to fly a new mission with an unmanned aircraft, with a UAV, for example, in an environment in which it has not been deployed before. So, for example, you have to fly a mission at night for which special image processing software is required. Now, wouldn't it be easy if you could just say, hey, there's an app for that. You can go and download the new image processing application, install it on the UAV, and fly your mission. Now, of course, I understand that there are many qualitative differences between an app for your iPhone and software for defense systems and for UAVs like Predator, so I don't want to trivialize the problem here, but yet the question is intriguing. Is there a way to extract basically the best of the commercial benefits of the App Store model into defense? So let's dig into that question just a little bit deeper, if you allow me to do that. So the App Store concept provides a stable platform for development. In fact, it's one of the reasons why the iPhone was so successful after its launch. Apple was already positioned as a platform provider like no other in the industry. If you look back at the Apple Macintosh and its operating system, it was really originally designed as an application platform. And what Apple did is they took that platform and implemented it in a handheld consumer device. So when others were still selling phones with additional built-in capabilities like email and web browsing, Apple provided an application platform for third parties. And the phone happened to be just one of those apps. The App Store allows you to quickly introduce new applications and capabilities into the market. So if you develop a new app, you can feature it in the App Store, and your app is immediately visible to all users. So as a result of that, the acquisition of a new app, and I'm purposefully using the word acquisition here, the acquisition of a new app is also very easy. I mean, gratification is immediate. You just click on a button, and the app gets downloaded and installed on your device immediately. And because of the low overhead on featuring new apps in the App Store, the App Store actually creates an environment in which small businesses can be successful. And because new capabilities are easy to introduce for developers and easy to try out for users, it creates an environment for innovation. So you may wonder, why am I telling you this? Well, look at the benefits on this slide. These are among the benefits that defense organizations today are looking for. What they want is faster introduction of new capabilities in the battlefield. They want reduced time between the identification and specification of a new need and the delivery of it. They are looking for an environment that fosters innovation and an environment that allows small businesses to participate successfully. Because these are basically the issues that are always on the agenda for all defense forces. And the move to a more asymmetric warfare environment has highlighted these issues more clearly. And I will talk about asymmetric warfare in a minute. But first, let's look at the requirements that are always on the agenda. Defense forces are always looking for more capabilities. There's always a need for new systems, new tanks, new ships, new aircraft, and this is partially driven by increasing levels of automation and autonomy of systems. Clear examples of that are the success of unmanned systems across all forces, but also efficiency improvements. For example, the new Zumwalt-class destroyer has only 142 sailors, and compare that to the 300 sailors on current destroyers. Also, we see an increased need for systems of systems integration. Systems and applications that were originally designed independently are now being connected together, are now being integrated. And the goals here really are information advantage through enhanced situational awareness and also improved speed of command. And at the same time, we see that the pace of innovation keeps increasing. And being able to deploy the latest technology in the field is critical. So there's a need for more frequent technology upgrades and more frequent new technology insertion. Now, contrast these requirements, these very fundamental requirements, with DoD R&D budgets. Those budgets are flat at best, we all know that. They are more likely declining, and this trend is expected to continue. So the bottom line is that we must be able to more rapidly deploy new systems and systems of systems at a lower cost than prior systems. And this is our challenge. And what I will explain next is how defense procurement agencies are changing their strategy to address this challenge. And an important aspect of that is the impact of asymmetric warfare. We can better understand the fundamental issues that defense procurement agencies are facing today by having a quick look at that. And I don't want to dwell on things you may already know, so I'll run through this quickly. So asymmetric warfare is impacting defense forces in many ways. For military system deployments, the nature of the threat is changing. The enemy is now most commonly asymmetric in nature, and it is adapting in the field to high-tech capabilities of systems fairly quickly. Systems, by the way, that have taken years to develop and deploy. And the commander in the field, so take the commander of a military vehicle, for example, may think, well, that's not a problem. I will just adjust my vehicle in the field. But the commander cannot do that. Each vehicle was uniquely developed by a separate prime systems integrator, and the field commander is not able to use his highly skilled engineers to adapt vehicle systems in the field. For that, he really needs access to system specialists from each systems integrator for each vehicle. And more importantly, he cannot take capabilities from one vehicle and use it into another. The vehicles simply don't have that modular architecture. Instead, each vehicle mostly has a unique systems integration architecture with unique interfaces. So defense forces are looking to increase agility in maintenance and support, but also in repurposing and upgrades of existing systems. And by the way, when I'm talking about agility, I'm talking mostly about the time dimension. So what I mean is that we need to get faster and faster about how we specify and build systems and how we deploy and adapt those systems to meet demands of asymmetric warfare. So now if we look at the situation today, then we see that defense procurement agencies follow a common approach, at least in the Western economies, so let's say the NATO countries. So what happens is that a major program is defined, and usually the program is defined around the need for a specific vehicle, aircraft, or ship, or, as is shown in this slide, around an unmanned aircraft system. And then next, after the program is defined, a Tier 1 Prime System Integrator is selected to deliver the system. The Prime Systems Integrator is responsible for the overall systems integration and the timely delivery of the system. And contracts are commonly tied to through life maintenance and management and possibly include training as well. Now, with system life cycles that span decades, such contracts are becoming an issue. And what we see is that defense procurement agencies and systems integrators are struggling to sustain the supply chain for multiple proprietary system designs. Because the system designs have limited or no commonality at the subsystem level. And in case of an unmanned aircraft system, for example, each system, so including the ground control station and the vehicle, basically constitutes a vertical silo. And as a result of that, there's lack of reusability across programs, across systems. So that means that there are no economy of scale opportunities for the defense procurement agencies across multiple vehicle procurements. And this drives up costs as each vehicle is extended in a one-off fashion. So as a result of this, a big shift is happening in how defense procurement agencies operate. Defense procurement agencies are now planning to mandate an open architecture and ensure continued adherence to this open architecture by the industry. The concept of open architecture by itself is not new. In fact, it has been around in some defense systems since around 2005. Navy open architecture, Navy OA, was the first. And historically, open architecture, or OA, has been used to drive the adoption of open standards and to drive the use of COTS technology in defense systems. And with that, the goal of OA is to reduce costs in system development. What we are talking about today is, in fact, fundamentally different from historic open architecture. The difference is not only that procurement agencies are now starting to mandate open architecture, but they are also specifying how that architecture should be defined. So they are now defining and mandating system integration strategy through the OA process, and this is a huge change, and it's also deeply necessary. For deployed systems, interoperability is directly connected to agility. And when I say interoperability, I'm not just talking about interoperability between systems, but also at the subsystem level. And specifying a common architecture across systems is a balancing act for the defense procurement agencies. For example, they should not go so far that it constrains innovation. And to specify a common architecture between systems, we must look for the one thing that does not vary across those systems. And this turns out to be the shared data model that systems need to function. And this observation that the shared data model is basically an invariant or can be an invariant across systems and programs, this observation has led to data-centric architecture. And I will explain in a little bit what data architecture is in more detail. But first, I'd like to point out that with data-centric architecture, it now becomes possible for procurement agencies to define the data to be used in a system in a standardized way. And this shared data model that is specified in a standardized way then becomes what you could call a system data dictionary, which is understood between systems. So it's a system data dictionary that spans systems and that spans programs. And with this system data dictionary, procurement agencies can then mandate how data is used and transmitted. And all this, they can do all this without defining any element of the system implementation. So it's purely at the data model, at the architectural level. And to separate this new approach from historic open architecture, a new term has been introduced. And this new term is interoperable open architecture, or IOA. And OA by itself is not enough to solve the needs of the armed forces. Sure, OA helps to save costs and drive COTS adoption, but it does not ensure that architecture is common across systems, nor does it ensure interoperability between subsystems, so not only within systems, but actually also across systems and programs. A truly interoperable open architecture is a type of system architecture that allows adding, upgrading, and swapping of components. We all know that in an integrated system, you must be able to swap hardware and software components simultaneously to achieve true open architecture. For standardized hardware, like hardware buses, like PCI and VME bus, for example, they have facilitated this objective for hardware, but it does not guarantee that the software can be swapped out as easily. Like hardware, software has to connect to a system-wide bus of some sort. Unlike hardware, however, the software must be very loosely coupled. The physical connectivity and transports may change over time, but the software still has to facilitate the basic functions of sharing data across subsystems. And several defense procurement agencies have now independently identified that a data-centric architecture is the ideal way to achieve the objective of interoperability. So that's why we say on this slide simply that interoperable open architecture, or IOA, is really the combination of historic open architecture with a data-centric systems integration strategy applied. Since interoperable open architecture is a new term, I want to try and make it a little bit more precise by showing some definitions. And I don't want to read through them right now, but just want to briefly point out a couple of things. So the DoD has put out a working definition for interoperability. And essentially, interoperability is the ability to share services between systems and even forces. Open architecture, on the other hand, is a well-established paradigm for promoting published standards. And if used correctly, the idea was that OA would lead to interoperability. Well, IOA is an extension of the OA paradigm to achieve interoperability explicitly, not only across systems, but also between system suppliers. And I'll talk about two examples of IOA, UCS and GVA, in a minute. But before doing that, I want to introduce data-centric architecture in a little bit more detail and explain how it enables IOA. So at the core of data-centric architecture is a plug-and-play messaging bus, or a plug-and-play data bus. This data bus provides a connectionless architecture which offers loose coupling required for interoperability. So how does this connectionless architecture work? Well, it's quite simple, really. Applications are basically categorized as publishers or providers of data and subscribers or consumers of data. There's no hard-coded interaction between applications. All communication occurs through this common data bus. So for example, on this slide, we have a sensor publishing sensor data. That could be tracks, for example. And then we have a control application that subscribes to the sensor data. It will then automatically start receiving updates of the sensor data once it has subscribed. And based on the received sensor data, the control application does some processing and then produces commands for an actuator It could be a robot arm, it could be a missile launcher, it could be anything. And there's no hard-coded knowledge in the applications about each other. So the sensor, the control application, and the actuator have no built-in knowledge about each other's existence. Applications are automatically discovered and connected at runtime, and this is what gives the plug-and-play capability to this architecture. So in this example, no changes are required to existing applications when you add a new sensor, for example. The sensor can just be added and it starts publishing its own sensor data. The same way, you can add a new display application. So if you want to add an operator in the loop, for example, you can add a display application. And this display application, once subscribed, will automatically start receiving sensor data from the sensor and status information from the actuator, which it can display then to the operator. And all the display application needs to do is connect to the data bus and subscribe to the required data. And in particular, no changes to the sensor and actuator are required. So the sensors and actuators don't need to know that they need to now send data to a display application. This is taken care of by the integration infrastructure. So another way to look at this, is that with data-centric architecture, connectivity becomes a runtime service rather than something that is hard-coded at design time. So at its very core, data-centric architecture provides a plug-and-play messaging bus, but this is not yet where the true value of data-centric architecture lies, though. Data-centric architecture is much more than just a messaging bus. The true value of data-centric architecture is that, like a relational database, data-centric architecture lets you define the data schema of data. An example of that is a common track database that is shared between various sensors, subsystems, and systems. And the common data schema enables integration of subsystems and systems. It makes all system components agree on a common vocabulary. So this is the system data dictionary that I talked about earlier. During deployment, the data schema, of course, gets populated with actual data. So for example, sensors start inserting and updating reported tracks. And then the distributed system state is maintained on the data bus. And any component that is aware of the data schema can connect at any time and start receiving the latest system state. In addition, the data bus provides fast local access to the latest state, and it does this by pushing out updates to consumers immediately. So when a consumer needs access to the current state of a radar track, it already has that value locally available. So this provides very fast local access to data, which enables the required real-time capabilities, like real-time threat assessment, weapon sensor allocation. All of those capabilities are based on the track database. So that's a quick high-level introduction to data-centric architecture. Let's look at an example here. And this is a real example, but the example is still at the system level. So this is not across systems yet. This example is Hawkeye, and it's and we'll look how data-centric architecture enables commonality and interoperability across systems in two other examples that I will show you next. So Hawkeye is is an early warning command and control aircraft, and the diagram shows the combat management systems architecture, which, as you can see, is a connection-oriented architecture. And at some point, a new capability needed to be added. And in this case, this was a cooperative engagement capability, or CEC. So the designers of the system set out to add this component, and what they found is that a whole bunch of new connections and interfaces need to be established to add this CEC component, as indicated by the red lines. And as you can see, this quickly creates spaghetti. So what they found is that adding the new capability leads to a cascading integration rework across many other components. So they considered organizing the components into modules, but that doesn't change reality. Longer term, it actually makes the problem worse by hiding component dependencies behind modules. So they decided to make the investment and migrate their design to a data-centric architecture, where the direct connections are now replaced by a common data bus. And adding CEC now becomes simple. You can hook up CEC to the data bus. It can then subscribe to the data it needs, and it will automatically get the data from the data bus. No changes to existing publishers are needed. So this illustrates the role of data-centric architecture in a single system and how it enables system change. What I want to do next is show how data-centric architecture enables interoperability across systems. So the first example that I want to look at is GVA, which stands for Generic Vehicle Architecture, and this is a program by the UK MOD. The program is about application of open system standards to military vehicles, and the MOD and the industry are working together in the program. They have developed an open modular and scalable generic vehicle architecture for the first time. So GVA is the first example of IOA that we were aware of. GVA addresses the integration of the entire electrical system in the vehicle. So that includes automotive control systems, power management, sensors, monitoring systems, et cetera, et cetera. The UK MOD drove IOA from an implementation as well as a business perspective. So they wanted a common technical integration approach across all future vehicles, but they also wanted a more open approach to the procurement process. And GVA is actually a perfect example of the IOA approach. The MOD took full responsibility for defining and maintaining the system data dictionary, and in the case of GVA, this system data dictionary is called the Land Data Model, which spans the complete vehicle on the subsystem level. So the system data dictionary, the Land Data Model, provides the dictionary for communication between subsystems on board the vehicle. And this is a fundamental change from the current approach, which mostly defines integration at the low protocol level and the message format level, which as we know, has created stovepipe systems in the past. The GVA program then goes on to mandate DDS, the DDS standard, for all data communication within the vehicle. So DDS is the data distribution service standard from OMG. And combined with the Land Data Model, DDS then provides the interoperability between subsystems. So one way to look at this is by saying that DDS provides integration at the protocol level and the Land Data Model provides integration at the semantic level. And the beauty of the data-centric approach is that the SDD can be openly shared, and indeed, most of the Land Data Model is now declassified, and this opens the door to interoperability and collaboration between countries. So the next slide shows the GVA architecture in a little bit more detail. And here you can see the shared data bus on top of the diagram. And you can see how it interconnects all subsystems. And this includes legacy subsystems, which is shown on the left. And the data connector that you see for each component is basically the system data dictionary for that particular subsystem. Last year, October, so that's around 1 year ago, several suppliers got together and provided an impressive demo of GVA. So it's not just paperwork, it's something that actually has been demonstrated already in practice. And the demo showed the level of subsystem integration that can be achieved. So three suppliers, Kinetic, Celex, Galileo, and Thales, came together, each with their own developed video systems. And these systems feature several types of cameras, joystick controllers, and multifunction displays. And because of the common system data dictionary by the GVA, they were able within a few hours to connect to each other's cameras, controllers, and displays. So the three vendors were then able to take control of each other's cameras, and they were also able to obtain video streams from another's camera. So the demo truly showed the plug-and-play capability and how this will become a reality in future military vehicles. And the GVA program is representative of what we can expect from the shift in defense procurement. And on this slide, I show you the guiding principles which will be characteristic of interoperable open architecture. And you will see the same principles in the second example that I will show you. And these principles are taken directly from the GVA specification. I don't want to go through this in detail, but I just want to point out that principles 1 through 6 highlight the objectives and benefits of the IOA approach. Basically, it shows how IOA takes a whole systems view, how it spans current and future systems, and how it supports rapid upgrades, repair, and changes to system. Then the next thing to note is that, and this is principle 8, that the Defense Procurement Agency takes responsibility for specifying the system's architecture. But at the same time, it is inviting participation from the industry. That's principle 7. And also, they don't want to strangle the specification to death, and they want to leave room for innovation. That's very important, and this is principle 9. And you will see the same principles applied in the second example that I want to quickly show you. And this second example is a very interesting program here in the U.S., which is UCS, which stands for Unmanned Air System Control Segment. The goal of UCS is to define a common architecture for all unmanned aircraft systems ground control stations, one common architecture that can be used across all services, so that's Army, Navy, and Air Force. UCS was driven by the government recognizing that buying a unique ground control station for each type of UAV is economically no longer viable. So UCS is now developing a common architecture for use with any ground control station. And the architecture breaks the ground control station down into modular components, and these components can then be plugged in to meet specific needs of any given unmanned vehicle. And the program is following an IOA approach to achieve this. Like GVA, UCS is an open technical society. Again, you see that the procurement agency is taking responsibility of the system architecture. And for UCS, this is the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics. And at the same time, you see that they are inviting participation from the industry. And actually, in UCS, there is a breadth of participation. All the UAV primes are involved across the services, Army, Navy, and Air Force. But also medium and small-sized businesses are involved, which are not necessarily UAV-centric businesses. And similar to GVA, the procurement agency, the OSD, is the principal stakeholder. They define and set the business objectives and acquisition goals, and the programs of record then specify the use cases and are the stakeholders in the implementation of the architecture. So this is one more diagram of UCS that I'd like to show you. And this diagram shows, very similar to the previous GVA example, that data-centric integration is again the enabler of the interoperable open architecture. This diagram actually shows a demonstrator of the UCS architecture. And in this demonstrator, 10 services from 5 different ground control stations were successfully integrated. The services included vehicle flight data, for example, sensor command and control, weather data from different services, from different servers, et cetera, et cetera. And again, DDS was selected as the integration technology, as the data bus underpinning the data-centric architecture. Okay, so that concludes my two examples that I wanted to share with you. And the last thing that I want to talk about in this webinar are the benefits that we can expect to see from this shift to interoperable open architecture. And here we have two systems, for example, two vehicles in this case. Both implement a data-centric architecture. So each vehicle, as you can see, implements the concept of a data bus. And this data bus is the virtual location where all relevant data and system state information exists. Contrast this, for example, with the current system architecture, where the system state is actually spread across the various subsystems, and where each subsystem offers varyingly level of capabilities to share its state. So now, with a data-centric architecture, these systems can go to one virtual place where they can access the system state, and this is the core building block for interoperability, as I can show you on this next slide. Because using IOA, it will become possible to swap subsystems between systems. So these can be subsystems from different suppliers even that were previously integrated into different systems. And this is exactly what the GVA demo showed, for example. So the multi-functional displays, the joysticks, and the cameras from the three different suppliers, they were able to plug those components into an Ethernet network, and within a few hours they were able to control each other's cameras with their joysticks and send display content to their multifunctional displays. And this was all possible because of the LAN data model, so the system data dictionary as well that was defined by the GVA. So that means that using this shared LAN data model, applications can now understand each other's data, and they use DDS as the standard interface to the data bus, giving the plug-and-play capability. So instead of swapping subsystems, you can also replace existing subsystems. So if a third-party supplier innovates a superior widget, for example, it now becomes possible to upgrade existing systems with that new capability. So this enables agility in the field. And also, system integrators can innovate within their own subsystems. You can do this either by using data that is already available from the data bus and data that the component did not use before, or the component can introduce new improved algorithms, or it can have an improved response time, or anything is possible there, basically. But we can also introduce whole new subsystem, providing a new capability not available before, like the CEC capability that was introduced in the Hawkeye command and control system, the example that I showed you earlier. So this illustrates that IOA truly provides a platform for innovation, where new capabilities can easily be added, even in fielded systems. When we were talking about the App Store earlier in the webinar, we weren't exactly kidding. Much like Apple's iOS, IOA provides a platform that hosts system capabilities. New capabilities can be added as these become available. Also, existing capabilities can be swapped, and functions that are no longer needed can be deleted. Unlike your iPhone, however, where apps are used mostly in isolation, integration between defense capabilities is fundamental. All capabilities must operate against a common operational picture. So IOA includes a data model that allows subsystems to share information and provide a standard interface to the data model. So subsystems can be plugged in and out off the shelf. So this brings me to the conclusion of this webinar. Over the next few years, we will definitely see a shift in how procurement agencies operate, and this shift is already upon us. It's demonstrated by programs like GVA in the UK and UCS here in the US, and it's driven by real requirements pushing for much improved agility in the field, and it's also driven by pressures in the sector. Those pressures are pushing for reuse and sharing of capabilities across programs and also across suppliers. The method that is applied in these new programs is IOA, Interoperable Open Architecture, And IOA builds on the experience from OA to achieve interoperability. The enabling technology for IOA is data-centric integration. And data-centric integration, as I have showed, decouples system components and provides a plug-and-play integration platform. So with that, I'd like to conclude my presentation. Thank you for your attention so far, and back to you, Kurt.
Very good. Thank you for that information. We've got a number of good questions, so let's get right to it. I'll try to group some of these so we can get as many as we can. First, there's a question about how are legacy systems supported by IOA? And there's a kind of a follow-up question that's similar in terms of how are there facilities in DDS that allow you to handle revision control of these IOA components? So when new things are deployed that may have slightly different dictionary definitions, older ones will know what to and not to gather or accept.
Correct. Those, excellent questions. So to start with the first question, how are legacy systems supported by IOA? Well, legacy systems are supported by IOA, and actually the GVA example that that I showed you earlier does include legacy components. I would say that data-centric architecture is an architecture of choice to support legacy systems, and this is because of the high level of decoupling that you get between system components in data-centric architecture. So basically what you would do with a legacy system is wrap it in a container that translates, that maps the legacy interface into a data-centric interface. And that container would then interface with the common data bus. So it isolates the legacy and quite possible proprietary interfaces. It hides those interfaces from the common infrastructure and maps those to the standard interfaces provided by the data bus. And because of the high level of decoupling, because there's no direct interaction between components and between subsystems, this wrapping can be done in a manner that is completely isolated from the rest of the system. So for system renovation in general, data-centric architecture is a very very good fit. The analogy that I sometimes use is that data-centric architecture, when you want to renovate a system, data-centric architecture, so for example, when you're remodeling your bathroom, data-centric architecture allows you to do that while still taking a bath in your bathroom. You can do two at the same time.
So you don't have to bite the bullet and just do it. You can actually wrap it and then kind of organize internally as you go.
Exactly.
In terms of revision control, if I can use that term, and what about revision control with deployed systems? Is there something in DDS that allows you to identify yourself as version X or something?
Yeah, something like that. So that was the second question. Sure. That's something that you will see, right? As systems evolve, as you modify components, as you add new components, you will also see that the data model evolves. And that's also something that GVA, for example, recognized, that as you roll out the land data model across different nation states, then there is certain classified information that cannot be made public, and also other countries will like and add their proprietary classified information to the data model. So it is very much necessary that you're able to extend the data model as you roll it out across systems.
Right.
And the DDS standard actually provides a special capability for doing that. It's called extensible types, or DDS X types, which is an add-on to the standard. It's still relatively new. And this standard actually allows you to extend existing data types. So it allows you to evolve your data model, and it allows components to coexist at the same time that interface either using the older version of the data model, and those components can coexist with other components that use newer versions of the data model.
Okay.
So it's basically a deployment time extensibility of your data model.
Okay, nice, great. Here's a question about how DDS is implemented. You use the word bus at a higher level, and I had this same issue in terms of typically people think of VME bus or something like that. I will point out that there are many other DDS archived webcasts over the past couple months that explain a lot about the bus, but maybe you could just take a few seconds and overview what you mean by bus when you're talking about it.
Right. So the bus in DDS is actually a virtual bus. So there's no central place you can point to and say, hey, that's the bus. DDS allows a completely distributed implementation without any servers, without any daemons in the network. You don't have to implement DDS that way, but RTI has implemented DDS that way. So our implementation architecture of DDS is purely peer-to-peer, and the data bus is completely distributed across all the participants in the network. So physically, it doesn't exist in any one location. It's fully distributed, and that makes the implementation very highly fault tolerant, for example.
Right. Okay, another question about someone wanting to know how it scales when you're going up to thousands of sensors or even more. What's the architecture underneath that avoids bottlenecking on this virtual bus?
Right, there are two aspects to that. So first, there is the protocol for discovery. As we speak, we are actually taking the next step into scalability, into the scalability of discovery. So discovery is when new components come online, and you need to connect to those new components. And thousands of sensors can actually be handled today by our implementation. We are actually moving to millions of devices out there in the field that need to be discovered. And of course, the way to do that is in a hierarchically structured protocol. So it's not a fully meshed architecture. There is a concept of hierarchy in there, which allows you to scale to those numbers. So that's discovery, and then there's also the actual data communication after devices have been discovered. And there, of course, you need to really take advantage of the capabilities of the underlying infrastructure. So, for example, when you have fan-out communication, you want to use multicast to send that data efficiently to all subscribers. And we have a highly optimized, reliable multicast protocol, for example, built on top of UDP to do that in a scalable fashion.
Okay. Here's a question about in IOA, how would you suggest to best organize the platform command and control function in a centralized configuration or a distributed kind of configuration?
Oh, definitely a distributed configuration. Actually, that's one of the things that data-centric architecture brings to IOA. It's a very loosely coupled organization of the components that provide a very high level of location transparency. So, for example, we have users of our technology who today start with a centralized implementation. So the system itself is decomposed into a large number of components all interacting through this data bus, but in reality it is implemented on a single computer. For example, on board a UAV, you can have all your processing being mapped onto a single CPU, because that's what you have available on board the UAV today. But then in the future, we are anticipating that we would have actually a local area network on board the UAV or some other type of bus. And then what data-centric architecture allows you to do is easily distribute those components across the various nodes. So with IOA, definitely think in terms of very loosely coupled components. This gives you, of course, the plug-and-play capabilities, but it also allows you to distribute the components across the network in a very flexible way.
I see. Very good. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. We apologize for those questions that we did not get to, but please feel free to follow up with RTI yourself, and RTI also will be getting the questions and will be contacting you directly. Appreciate all of you for attending today's eCast, and thank you, Dr. DeYoung, for taking the time to be with us and share some really important insights on DDS open architecture for defense initiatives. I'd like to remind you that there's also, besides the archived webcasts on DDS from RTI, there's also a December 7th event, so make sure that you're signing up for that. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen. An audio-only podcast version will also be made available. You can do a web search using the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media eCasts available for download as MP3s. We also have a multi-core tech group where we follow RTI and a number of other hardware and software vendors that are multi-core related. We invite you to join that at multi-core_tech. Thank you for attending, and have a great day.